everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated, the podcast. I'm your host, Claire Malky. Usually this time of year, the fall, that is, I'm pulling out my favorite scarves and drinking a nice warm cup of apple cider. Well, I'm still doing those things, but from the comfort of my apartment, while simultaneously screaming into the void. Speaking of which, this week was exciting, wasn't it? Between the New York Times article about Trump's tax returns to the first presidential debate, this week was a doozy. In light of these events, I hope you took some time to read up on Trump's tax evasions, as well as perusing both his and Biden's presidential plans. Fun fact, by the way, my alma mater, Hofstra University, held presidential debates in 2008, 2012, and 2016, the last I was at school for. What a time that was in 2016. The excitement, the energy. We also got like 3 days off of classes, which was pretty rad. But who knew what we were in for with Mr. Trump as president? To digress from Trump for a moment, we have a spectacular show in store for you all this week. Up first, we've got this week's top headlines, then our deep dive on statues and monuments, and we'll round out the show with my interview with former high school teacher turned Episcopalian priest, Daryl Prophet. It's a little known fact that you can, in fact, drink a margarita during the fall. With that being said, grab your marg, or PSL if you're one of those people, and let's get started. Up first, this week's headlines. On Sunday, it was revealed that in the last 10 years, Trump has not paid taxes through a series of loopholes called fraud. But I wouldn't call Mr. Trump a fraud. I would just call him a real tax hole. A new poll showed that a majority of Americans believe that a new Supreme Court justice should not be decided until a new president is elected. But then again, when did Republicans ever care about what voters wanted? On Monday, scientists announced that they have found bodies of water on Mars, compared to every other day when anyone can find bodies in water in Jersey. But seriously, this is a big deal. For years, scientists have hypothesized about life on other planets. This recent discovery is proof there's more life out in the universe than there is on the internet forums. Because as we all know, water equals life. Unless you live in Lincoln Park, then I guess brunch equals life. And water is just that thing that you have to sometimes drink in between mimosas. Ew, no, I really don't want that drinky stuff. I just want a mimosa. I don't want any water. Speaking of Lincoln Park, if you live there, you probably pay more on your monthly rent than President Trump paid on his federal income taxes. Who needs that stylish two-bed, three-bath with a balcony and AC when you could simply cheat the system? So much easier, right? This week, the biggest news was, of course, the presidential debate, or as I ended up calling it, Wallace and Gromit and the Case of the White Supremacist. Welcome to the 2020 presidential debate, aka keep as many cats on one chair as possible. The whole debate was like one giant metaphor for the three monkeys. Trump looked like he couldn't hear a direct question, Biden looked like he couldn't recognize where he was, and Wallace couldn't get a word in edgewise. Chris Wallace had about as much success corralling Trump's wild statements as California has had stopping forest fires by raking leaves. Speaking of fires, when asked about forest management, Trump claimed that the forest floor is loaded up with dead trees. You drop a cigarette in there and the whole forest burns down. The response not only shows he's out of touch with the environmentalists, but also with the Gen Z crowd. Who even smokes cigarettes anymore? Ew. Oh, hey Alexa, remind me to buy more Fruity Tooty Jewel Pots when I go to CVS. Thanks. Overall, it was a less than presidential debate. The White House apparently blocked a CDC order grounding cruise ships until February. The move has been rejoiced by people such as cruise lobbyists, Florida politicians, and the coronavirus.
And that was this week's headlines.
During the debate on Tuesday, Trump again purported that if America had more forest cities like they do in Europe, these fires in California would be under control. Not only did the agricultural minister of Austria disavow this claim, but so did the Queen of Fairies and her Council of Woodland Creatures. To give us a little perspective on the state of forest cities, we have the Queen of Fairies herself, Queen Titania. Your Majesty, welcome to Sit Still, Look Opinionated.
Greetings, Claire. It's a blessing to be here today.
So, Queen Titania, you're usually pretty elusive when it comes to human politics. I don't think we've seen you since the 1600s when there was some miscommunication with Grecian lovers.
Don't remind me of that ghastly incident.
Oh, my deepest apologies.
Granted.
So, Queen Titania, why have you, at this particular moment, emerged from the depths of the woodland forests?
Well, I must say, Claire, there's an elephant in the room, isn't there?
Well, yeah, naturally.
This week, Puck brought me news that a melted orange man claimed that forest cities are responsible for the health of the forests, and I must say I was quite offended.
Did he say something wrong?
Oh, the idea that humans would take responsibility for their actions? Huh, nothing has changed since I fell in love with that ass.
I thought you said not to mention that.
The queen can speak as freely as she wishes. What you humans need to realize is that this earth belongs to more than just you. If you simply let the forests be, as opposing to expand, these fires would naturally occur and not harm anyone.
But don't you think these fires are a product of climate change?
Why, of course I do, Claire. Who do you think is responsible for climate change? Humans. I have been on this earth for thousands of years and have only witnessed terrible things from humans. The only good one I met was part donkey.
I'm confused. Do you want me to mention that incident or not?
I want you to listen, Claire. Just look at history. These last forest fires? Humans. Oil spills? Humans. Chernobyl? Humans. I used to go on vacation there, you know. Now, it's all gone.
But Queen Titania, we're not all bad. Some of us are really good.
This is true. The departure of my one true love still haunts me. It makes it worse having to see him on TV next to that idiot orangutan. But I wish him all the best with his political career.
Are you talking about Biden? I thought the donkey's name was Bottom. Wait, are they the same person? I mean, I knew Biden was old, but like not that old.
Alas, I've said too much. A queen never kisses and tells. Fairies away!
Thank you for your time, Fairy Queen. If you do want to learn more about prescribed burns and why fires naturally occur, check out our Season 1 episode on the environment. Our interview guest, Julia Gomel-Dunn, goes in-depth about the environment and the effects that natural fires have. This week's episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated is brought to us by Theater in the Dark, A War of the Worlds, a virtual audio drama. Link to tickets will be listed in the show notes.
No one would have believed.
You see this? What's happening in the suburbs?
In the first years of the 21st century.
Wi-Fi's not working.
That this world was being watched keenly and closely.
What's happening?
By intelligences greater than our own.
That's in Kankakee. We should drive out and see it.
Careful. Don't get too close.
Dr. Pearson, have there been fresh attempts to signal these beings?
This October.
It's something more than a meteorite.
Theater in the Dark presents...
It's a cylinder.
And it's opening.
A War of the Worlds. A virtual audio drama performed live every night over Zoom. Pay what you can tickets available now at theaterinthedark.com.
Up next, this week's deep dive. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed." And on the pedestal, these words appear: "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck. Boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. That was Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley. You might have heard it before on Breaking Bad or Watchmen or even British crime show Endeavor. But why is an English romantic poem so prominent on today's television networks? Or part of your favorite comedy and politics podcast? Well, that's for me to know and you to find out. In light of that, today we look to address a topic that I didn't even comprehend was a political issue until now. Well, because it's 2020, and America seems to be on fire, and continues to actively try and put out that fire by using more fire. As I've mentioned before on the podcast, I hail from a city in Virginia that's known for its ties to the Civil War. Not only was my hometown occupied by the Union Army from 1861 to 1864, but it was also the birthplace of Robert E. Lee. Despite all of this, as a child, the Civil War always felt deep in the past, like, yeah, those times were bad, but this is the future now. Everything is okay. Little did I know that the traces of the Civil War were littered around me. Every day on my way to school, my parents and I drove past a monument called the Appomattox. It was a statue of a young man in a Confederate uniform, facing south, and standing in classical contrapposto. I see all you art history nerds. This statue was meant to honor the memory of the Confederate dead. I'm 100% serious there was an engraving on the statue that said those actual words. For years, my hometown wrestled with what to do with the statue. Keep it up, take it down, it was a whole thing. But to understand this, should I stay or should I go, question a little more, we have to understand why statues exist in the first place. So let's start with why people build statues. When I think about the first recorded statues, my mind jumps to things like ancient Greece or ancient Egypt or ancient Mesopotamia. Is that redundant? Ancient Mesopotamia? Is there a modern Mesopotamia? I'm asking the hard-hitting questions here, guys. Point is, when I think about statues built during those times, what purpose did they serve? Well, for the really old ones, Egypt, Mesopotamia, statues were built and erected to pay homage to the gods or animals. The thought being that if these statues were built in their image, then the people would be granted blessings. According to an article written by the BBC, the earliest known statue is about 40,000 years old. It was a small statue that depicted the body of a woman with the head missing. The idea being that the statue was to be worn, having the wearer's head replace the head of the statue, and was thought to bring fertility to the wearer. However, the first historically known statue depicting mankind dates back to the Neolithic era around 5000 BC. I say Neolithic like I know what that means. That BFA in acting is really paying off, y'all. The statue in question, known as the Thinker of Cernavoda, gains its significance as it seems to be the first statue to portray human introspection rather than the typical focus of hunger or fertility. Fast forward a little, and by the time we get around to ancient Greece and Rome, we still see statues of gods, but also thrown into the mix are statues of politicians and the wealthy and the beautiful. It seemed that the erecting of statues correlated to the erecting of status. And while the human species went through a renaissance of artistic expression, it was still those who were endowed with power and status who commissioned and benefited from the creation of these statues. I feel like the idea is further expanded upon when we jump to more modern, more documented examples of the intentions behind building statues. In 1831, Brussels commissioned for the state-sponsored erection of statues in response to their revolution for independence from the Kingdom of the Netherlands. Having been inspired by the French Revolution, the people earned their independence from monarchic rule.
But the new state didn't have a rich history or culture to coalesce the image of their government. As a result, the new political elites of the era commissioned and primarily funded statues of cultural Belgian leaders, who often lived and died long before the revolution, in an attempt to create the feeling that while the democracy was young itself in Belgium. Again, I feel the need to point out that erecting of these statues were typically to honor and admire revolutionary figures. They built statues of their role models. So, how does this relate back to the good old US of A? Well, if you've traveled across this country, especially in the South, but not limited to, I'm sure you've seen monuments and statues dedicated to Confederate war heroes. In 2019, the Southern Poverty Law Center counted 1,747 publicly sponsored symbols that honored the Confederacy in one shape or another. This includes schools, bridges, memorials, flags, and recognized holidays. And of that number, 780 of these Confederate memorials are public statues. IMO, that's about 780 too many. So, if we agree that back in the day, statues and monuments were meant to praise gods and create communities, why are there Confederate statues all over this country? Well, the same reason a lot of shit goes down. A misleading narrative rooted in systemic racism. Shocker! A little-known fact about these Confederate statues is that they weren't erected during the active years of the Confederacy. A significant number of these monuments were erected in response to the formation of Jim Crow laws in the early 1900s and the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Take a look at Stone Mountain in Georgia, for example. This exceptionally massive memorial to Confederate generals was started in 1915 and wasn't fully finished until 1970. That's more than 100 years after the Confederacy fell. That really just blows my mind. I've also been to Stone Mountain probably a dozen times, and I'm embarrassed to say I just learned last year that it's a Confederate monument. These are subliminal messages, y'all. The majority of these monuments were put up by the Daughters of the Confederacy and the Sons of the Confederate Cause. By the way, these groups still exist. That totally confuses me. Like, why would anyone today in their right mind sign up for a membership? These two gross organizations like to promote a false narrative called the Lost Cause. A 1999 applicant to the National Register of Historic Places describes the Lost Cause in his defense of protecting a statue of Confederate General Beauregard in New Orleans. It goes a little something like this. And yeah, if you were born in 1999, you're old enough to drink now, and a lot has changed since then. But this argument of the Lost Cause still weasels its way into historical defenses today. So, hear it out. The cult of the Lost Cause has its roots in the Southern search for justification and the need to find a substitute victory for the Civil War. In attempting to deal with defeat, Southerners created an image of the war as a great, heroic epic. A major theme of the cult of the Lost Cause was the clash of two civilizations, one inferior to the other. The North, invigorated by constant struggle with nature, had become materialistic, grasping for wealth and power. The South had a more generous climate, which had led to a finer society based upon veracity and honor in man, chastity and fidelity in women. Like tragic heroes, Southerners had waged a noble but doomed struggle to preserve their superior civilization. There was an element of chivalry in the way the South had fought, achieving noteworthy victories against staggering odds. This was the Lost Cause as the late 19th century saw it. A whole generation of Southerners set about glorifying and celebrating it. Which, if you think about it, it makes sense. No one wants to look back and have their ancestors remembered as losers or evil. Something that's hard not to do when they end up on the wrong side of the history books. But let's look at these arguments and see if they hold water, or if they really are thinly veiled attempts to preserve racism as a way of life. One of the main arguments I hear on Facebook all the time is that taking down these Confederate monuments is wrong because they are part of American history. Which, yeah, I guess it is, but so is the Revolutionary War and we don't have statues of King George in front of courthouses. Remember, people, the Confederacy tried to leave the United States of America to start their own country. Which is why it doesn't make sense to me that there are people who call themselves hardcore Americans who fly the flag of a group that tried to leave the country that they're so apparently proud of. Like, what? It's an inaccurate representation of history. And again, as we established earlier, monuments and statues are often erected to honor those who we look up to. That means that defenders of these statues honor and idolize the individuals who tried to leave our country and their ideals. Just listen to this quote from the Southern Poverty Law Center. In Abbeville, South Carolina, a monument erected in 1906 is inscribed with a poem that reads, in part, "The world shall yet decide, in truth's clear, far-off light, that the soldiers who wore the gray and died with Lee were in the right." Yep, in hindsight, they were right. Slavery has definitely aged well. Another point here is that we don't learn history only through monuments. We engage with history in school. I'm pretty sure I've never just looked at a statue and been like, yes, now I understand the intricacies of war. Like, that definitely didn't happen. Historian and professor at Harvard University, Annette Gordon Reed, put it this way. History will still be taught. We will still know who Robert E. Lee was, who Jefferson Davis was, who Frederick Douglass was, who Abraham Lincoln was. There are far more dangerous threats to history. Defunding the humanities, cutting history classes and departments, those are the real threats to history. And if that still doesn't drive home the point, here's a tweet from Radley Balco, a journalist in layman's terms, on Twitter. "The erasing history people have a point. They took down the Nazi statues too, and today no one knows what a Nazi is." Let's transition now to the second argument I see all the time, which is Confederate statues and monuments are not racist. Except the main reason that the Confederacy tried to secede was due to the fundamental disagreement over the ownership of Black people as slaves. I think the best way to encompass Confederate ideals is to look directly at what their leaders said about their vision of a country free from ours. As the Confederacy's vice president, Alexander H. Stephens, said on March 21, 1861, in his cornerstone speech of the virtue of the new government, "The new Constitution has put at rest, forever, all the agitating questions related to our particular institutions of African slavery as it exists amongst the proper status of the Black man in our form of civilization. This was the immediate cause for the late rupture and present revolution." Stephens continues, "The Confederacy's foundations are laid. Its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Black man is not equal to the white man, that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth." Also, just an FYI, we changed the phrasing of how Vice President Stevens referred to Black people because I didn't feel comfortable with the language he used to address them. When you actually read the history of it, the Confederacy called out their need for a racist society as a reason to create a whole new nation and to go to war with their country. Shouldn't that be considered treason against the United States? Actually, yes. The Confederacy levied war against the federal government of the United States, which is a chargeable offense. By 1863, Lincoln had a list of Confederate generals that he planned on trying for treason against the U.S. But all that changed when John Wilkes Booth murdered President Lincoln at Ford's Theater. Those plans came to a startling halt when Johnson became president. Johnson shifted his focus to Reconstruction rather than punishment. Not to mention that Johnson also had a sweet spot for the South. Because of this, not a single Confederate leader was ever tried for treason against the United States. In my opinion, that's some seriously flawed governing. This is my own speculation here, but this seems to be a big reason why the Confederate identity still exists. They basically got a slap on the wrist and a stern talking to. The leaders got away scot-free, and there was nothing in their way of holding on to their ideals. If you're still having trouble connecting this thought process, think of it this way. No one in their right mind would erect a statue of Hitler. Even though the Third Reich was a major historical moment in Germany, pretty much everyone understands that at its core, that government prioritized eradicating Jews and ethnic cleansing. Now, I haven't personally been to Germany, but I'm pretty damn positive that there aren't schools called Adolf Hitler High School or Adolf Eichmann Memorial Bridge. That would be horrifying. However, if we're looking at it from his supporters' side, I'm sure he did great things for the economy. And if you're thinking, "But Claire, taking down the statues doesn't actually do anything. Why don't these protesters use their energy to actually get stuff done?" Okay, just tell me how comfortable you feel about changing the status quo when towering images of the oppressor stand above you. Removing Confederate statues not only allows our communities to feel respected, but it also allows a painful chapter in American history to heal. Like, why do we need to keep picking at the scab? Just listen to what Robert E. Lee had to say about it. I think it wiser, moreover, not to keep open the source of war, but to follow the examples of those nations who endeavored to obliterate the marks of civil strife, to commit to oblivion the feelings engendered. The literal general of the Confederate Army said that. If y'all are so obsessed with him, listen to his guidance. Let's close this chapter and move on. So why should you, our listeners, care about the statues and monuments around you? Well, it's all about empathy and respect. By allowing these Confederate monuments and statues to remain standing, these states, cities, and towns are sending a message that they sympathize with the core values of the Confederacy, which again, were that the white man should have ultimate political and economic power. If we are truly trying to grow and become a more accepting society, then it's about time to overhaul these monuments. And if you know someone who vehemently defends these statues, maybe ask them why they feel that way and see if it lines up with any of the arguments we talked about today. For an episode filled with quotes and poems, I think it best to end with another quote from Ozymandias himself. I'm too old for this shit.
Next, my interview with former high school teacher and retired Episcopalian priest, Daryl Prophet.
So for today's interview, we have Daryl Prophet. He has had a lot of different careers, including a high school teacher and an Episcopal priest. So welcome to the show, Daryl Prophet. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah. So to give our listeners a little bit of background, could you give us a little bit about who you are?
Yeah, I'm, as you mentioned, I'm an Episcopal priest, but I have been a priest for nearly 30 years. In 2018, I actually took early retirement.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. But the circumstances were a bit difficult in that my wife and I suddenly and unexpectedly lost our oldest son. And so I actually, if you wanted to talk about grief, I'm probably an expert on grief through all that we experienced with his loss. So I attempted to go back to do all the work as a priest. In 2018, actually it was 2017 that he died in March of 2017. But by February 2018, I just decided that I just couldn't go on, and I needed to do a lot of healing. And so I also very much wanted to write a book. And so I retired to work on my own healing and also to begin writing my book. And so fortunately, my healing is well underway, but my book isn't done yet. So I'm hoping to finish my book this coming year sometime, and I'll be very happy if that takes place. And so, but I am husband of 41 years. My wife and I have three children. Two of them are living. One lives in Washington, D.C.
Oh, wow.
And, she's kind of doing something experimental in D.C. She's working for a public school.
Oh, wow.
A charter school, but they have introduced the Montessori method to public schools. And my son-in-law, her spouse, is a nurse instructor at Children's National in Washington, D.C. So he's been right in the middle of all this COVID stuff. And my younger son lives in Lawrence, Kansas. That's where we live. And he has his degree in history, but he is a chef at the DG House in Lawrence. And so we get to see him, unfortunately, not as much as we were before COVID hit.
Yeah.
And one of our hobbies is to camp, and that's why I'm on the telephone and right now in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. We've been here for, not Glenwood Springs, but Colorado for about 3 weeks. And it's been very restful. One week it snowed, though, and it got very cold at night, but mostly it's been beautiful weather. We're camped right alongside the Colorado River and just having a great time.
Wow. I thank you so much for that introduction. I'm so sorry about the loss of your child. That is...
I appreciate that. Yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah, that's a difficult thing that a lot of people don't understand. Grief is just really, really hard work. I know we're not talking about that, but in some ways we are.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of grief in this country. And
yeah.
So it's very difficult work, but very important work, because if one doesn't do grief work, it stays. It just goes subterranean. And that's what I fear for our country right now, is a lot of our grief has gone underground and it's emerged in recent years in a very profound way. And one day, hopefully sooner than later, will be dealt with.
Yeah, that is such a good point, because if you don't take care of the problem, it just festers and becomes more invasive. Nothing ever really, in terms of our country, gets resolved.
Right. And it's not, I use the word subterranean very carefully, because it just goes underground. And when something's underground, you don't see what it's doing. It's like like a sore that heals too fastly on the skin, and yet it still festers underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I think what our country is facing right now has lanced the wound, which could be good news if we handle it correctly. Could be bad news if it's mishandled.
Yeah, very true. Before we started recording, we had talked a little bit about how imagery is very important in both history and religion. What are your thoughts about that in terms of statues and monuments in this country?
Yeah, it's fascinating, because it seems to me there's two levels here that are going on. One is some deep systemic thinking about who we want to raise up as models.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of it. And then there's another part of it that I think is a bit misguided. And that is to somehow memorialize historical events, even if they're problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean not that we should forget history, but when you put a memorial, let me use a biblical allusion, if you'll allow.
Yeah.
There's a in Israel, in ancient Israel, when they went into the Promised Land, they immediately created a memorial. And that memorial was to remind them of what had happened, that God had delivered them from the hands of Pharaoh. Even though they wandered 40 years in the desert, they crossed the River Jordan, and immediately they built a monument. And it was to remind themselves of the greatness of God. Well, in our country, some of the memorials that have been under attack, you might go all the way back to Columbus, but mm-hmm. I think the most recent ones and the ones that have been in the news the most are the Civil War memorials.
Mm-hmm.
And the Civil War memorials were never, it's fascinating to me as a historian that how people, they recast history in a revisionist way to say that these memorials like of Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson or people like that were built to honor the greatness of these men, despite the fact that they were fighting on the wrong side of the Civil War. But that's not why they were built. They were built, there's a few exceptions, but most of them were built either in the 20s with the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan, and in the 60s with the, and 50s and 60s with the emerging civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't to memorialize these great leaders. It was to memorialize the disenfranchisement of African Americans. And so when the criticism came that somehow we were forgetting history, in my mind, that's the wrong conversation. That's not what's going on. You don't have to have a memorial in order to remember history. But one should examine why one might want to put a memorial of an individual for all time, relatively speaking, and find out why it is you're wanting to do that. So, in fact, I have a friend of mine who's an Episcopal priest in Austin, Texas, and they went through the process of removing a stained glass window behind their altar. And the reason they did that was the name of the church is All Saints.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an old hymn in the church that celebrates the saints. And part of the lyrics is, one was a soldier. And so
yeah.
The soldier they had was of Robert E. Lee.
Oh, wow.
And my friend said, you know, he thought that was odd, but he didn't really think too much about it until an African-American came up to him and said to him, every time he goes to communion, he can barely take communion because he has to look away.
Mm-hmm.
And so they began a process that ended long before this most recent unpleasantness in our country, several years ago, and they removed the Robert E. Lee stained glass window, and they replaced it with the first African-American Episcopal priest in this country, Absalom Jones, which I thought was magnificent. That's who you want to lift up.
Yeah.
Somebody, you know, you want to, no one would talk about removing a Frederick Douglass statue or, you know, or memorialize the Civil Rights Act of 1964 or, you know, memorialize the Emancipation Proclamation or, you know, so many examples like that. And so it's an important conversation, but so often it gets stuck, and people can't even talk from both sides of this issue because they're not talking about the same thing. And so when you're having a conversation and one person is operating on assumptions that are completely different than the other person, how can you even have that conversation? You can't. You just end up both sides being mad at one another, and the conversation ended, and then either the statue gets tipped over or it remains.
Yeah. And that's a big part of this podcast is having those conversations and trying to understand another point of view or something that maybe you weren't even aware of was going on. I'm from Virginia, and, you know, there were statues all over my hometown and, you know, high schools called, you know, Jeb Stuart and places like that. And it's been really interesting to kind of watch those things be changed, and people learn that it's not necessarily just that history didn't exist, but it's that, what is that deeper meaning? Why was it placed there in the first place? Which
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think this is really good news. I mean, but we live in such a polemical society right now that we can't even have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We divide, you know, we live in an echo chamber where we only get information that supports where we are. You know, the whole internet is set up with algorithms to support that. Facebook, social media, all of that is set up to keep us in our echo chamber, and so we don't have conversations with the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, then these things remain, and then it unfortunately sometimes results in violence.
Yeah.
You know, it's just fascinating to me too, like perhaps you heard today that President Trump pressed his case that U.S. schools are indoctrinating children with a left-wing agenda hostile to the nation's founding fathers. And I found that really fascinating because, you know, you wonder if people who are thinking about that we've indoctrinated, you know, generations of young people into some sort of left-wing thought patterns. I wonder if they realize that the first act of insurrection against the British during the American Revolution was the toppling of King George statues in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just fascinating me. You know, it fascinates me. But I think I have to get beyond fascinated.
Yeah.
Because ask myself the question, how am I either standing against this in a thoughtful way, or how do I collude? How am I colluding with it with my silence?
Yeah.
Because I fear that I just live in my own echo chamber. So I try really hard. A great example for me would be my social media presence. I try really hard not to delete people who disagree with me,
mm-hmm.
and try to engage somewhat in a conversation, although nobody ever changed anybody's mind on social media. But
true.
Just to give kind of a kernel of, I don't know, opposition thought that's well-reasoned.
Mm-hmm. And to approach it, you know, in that conversation. And that's something, you know, stepping away from history and thinking about religion too as well. That's something you always hear in religion, like, or how are you in conversation with this verse or things like that? So yeah, you have to open up a dialogue and meet them where they're at.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, especially, you know, it seems to me, and since you invited on my show, you can silence me if I go too far here. But, you know, it seems to me that since white evangelical America seems to support the continuation of these monuments that celebrate racists who own slaves,
mm-hmm.
you have to understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
Because I think immediately our thoughts, at least for most people that I know, is somehow they're just bad people.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think that that's true. I think misinformed, perhaps not well read about this topic, but to reject them out of hand is to lose the opportunity to make a difference, to get that subterranean grief is what I called it when we began, because mm-hmm. I think it is about grief. You know, I don't think we're over the Civil War.
Yeah.
I know when you're 20-something, you know, 10 years ago was a long time. But in the whole scope of history, U.S. history, world history, you know, 1865 wasn't that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are some people who still remember people alive who were alive then.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and so I think there's a lot of grief here. There's a lot of grief about a country torn asunder. There's a lot of grief about how it all ended. There's a lot of grief still about Lincoln's assassination that we wouldn't be able to, I don't think too many people would be able to articulate or say, oh yeah, the reason I feel this way is I have grief that Lincoln was assassinated. Now, I don't think very many people would say that, or anybody would say that, but I do believe that that's an issue. I believe that grief is still is with us and we haven't dealt with it. Now it's popping up as it always does. It never goes away. It pops up. And now we're going to have to deal with it. Unfortunately, as I said, living in our echo chambers, it's hard to have a conversation with somebody on the other side of this.
Yeah. And kind of speaking into that echo chamber and sort of around it, how do you, in your perspective, think is a good way to engage with someone if they say, oh, well, taking down a statue doesn't do anything, you know, it doesn't, you know, give people rights or, you know, change laws? What are your sort of thoughts on that take?
Well, you know, it's like about anything else.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a relationship with somebody where I can have difficult conversations, then I can have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But if I don't have a relationship with them, if all I know is their cute puppy pictures on Instagram, and, you know, their movie reviews on Facebook, then I'm probably not going to be able to have a conversation like that. It's going to have to be with somebody that knows my heart, that knows that, you know, that I'm not some crazy wacko, that there's some thoughtfulness that goes into what I'm saying. Then we can engage in a conversation, but I can't go into it thinking I've got to change that person's mind. I have to have an openness to say, look, I want you to tell me what I'm not seeing here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it tends to look pretty clear to me, but I also read the books that I read, see the documentaries that I watch, and I'm not watching what you're watching. I don't even get my news from the same source that you do. So we're not going to naturally be able to have a conversation of openness. Only when that trust is built. And so the question then becomes, are we willing to do that? Because it's so easy to write people off.
Mm-hmm.
It's so easy to say, you're a nutcase, right-wing nutcase, left-wing nutcase. I don't have anything to learn from you. I don't have anything to hear from you. And so because of that, then those conversations can't take place. But we don't, you know, our society has shifted so much that we don't have the same kind of relationships that we used to. Mm-hmm. I read a book a number of years ago called Bowling Alone. It used to be that you joined a bowling team. I don't bowl, but you know what I mean here.
Yeah.
I'm an Episcopal priest. Why would I bowl? You know? But, you know, if we go bowling, we go on a Wednesday night. There's no longer a team there. We just bowl by ourselves and we go home.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that changed America really was the garage door opener. Because it used to be back a long time ago that you drove up, you got out of your car, and guess what? Your neighbor was getting out of his or her car, and you had a conversation. We had big front porches. Now we have small front porches and privacy fences and garage door openers and air conditioners where we stay in and HBO and Netflix and what have you. You know, and so we're just not engaged with one another. The sense of community has disappeared. And until that reemerges, and it only reemerges one person at a time, you know, there's no law that could be made. There's no, you know, I don't know. Maybe you would hope this, you know, a tragedy like COVID might change some things. But even with that, what has happened? Wearing a mask are now, that's a political thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's become very political, and people are surprised by that. I'm not surprised by it. I expected it because COVID fit into the society that already exists.
Yeah.
What already exists is a divisive society of a bunch of echo chambers.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good point. I saw something recently on Facebook about how, yeah, our society has kind of morphed itself into COVID seamlessly, and how, you know, you don't have to smile at anyone and you can just walk away from someone and there's no questions about it, which is totally understandable.
Oh, yeah.
About COVID.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned,
I just noticed that, you know, today we're in downtown Glenwood Springs and people even get out of the aisle with, you know, you have no human contact with mm-hmm. anybody, you know, and for some people it's thank God this is here. But for an extrovert like me, it's like, oh my God, how am I going to live like this? You know?
Yeah, I completely understand. You mentioned community before too, and that kind of makes me think about statues and monuments as well, because if that is, you know, a main part of a town or a main feature, my brother lives in Richmond, Virginia, and just hearing about all of their statues and monuments that are, you know, a historic part of Richmond, Virginia, but they are, you know, having to sort of reimagine what that city looks like. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that's awesome. You know, I mean, because it's like, you know, it's like my friend removing the Robert E. Lee stained glass window and replacing it with the first African American Episcopal priest. I mean, we have such a rich history,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that was such a struggle. I mean, but we have to be really honest with ourselves. You know, America is a United States is a country with a deeply racist core.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, we're going to run into this. I mean, we, you know, all men are created equal, right? Declaration of Independence, but only white men, not women, not people of color. You know, we're the country of the Trail of Tears. We're indigenous people. We're led away from their homes in Georgia to Oklahoma, and thousands died along the way. The Ku Klux Klan, you know, so, and it goes on and on and
yeah.
on. And the key here for me is not to deny that.
Yeah.
But don't raise it up as a model to emulate. And that's what monuments do.
Mm-hmm.
They raise up people as someone to emulate, and there's nothing to emulate when it comes to Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee. Now, you could also say, well, George Washington had slaves. Yes, he did, and that needs to be told. I mean, that needs to be said. We don't need to hide from this. We need to embrace it, because I think what uniquely makes this country different is our ability to self-examine,
yeah.
to be self-critical.
And if we lose that, and I'm afraid there's a movement out, I'm not afraid, because I think, you know, the justice will be found. I think that the universe is set up in such a way where the arc of the universe bends towards justice. And so I think that there's nothing to fear here. If anything, it's pretty fascinating to see it happen in our lifetime. So we need to not, you know, you hear a lot about American exceptionalism, and that goes against the grain with me, other than the fact that we're no more special than any other country except for our ability to be self-critical, to make adjustments. Just look at the history of the United States. We have made adjustments as we've come along. You know, the Declaration of Independence was really for just not just white males, but white property owning males. Mm-hmm. And look where we've come. Look, you know, I mean, just within your listener's lifetime, what we have seen is the equality of marriage.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that happening in the 60s? You know, we're in the 60s, and your listeners don't know this, or maybe they know this, but they didn't see this. And I saw it myself, where people of mixed races were looked down on if they were together. I'm not just talking about being married. I'm talking about dating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you go back and watch an old Sidney Poitier movie, The Sir with Love, or, you know, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, I guess is the movie I'm thinking of, where a white woman brings an African-American boyfriend home to meet her parents for the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's, you know, that's not back to the Civil War. That's back to the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have seen a lot of improvement, but we cannot stop. This is a critical time in the history of this country. And so I want us to remain self-critical, to be self-examine who it is that we want to lift up in a monument. And it has nothing to do with forgetting history. In fact, a lot of history that we've been told just needs to be forgotten because it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Just today, I heard the criticism from our president of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've ever looked through that, but that's a very critical look.
Yeah, I have it on my shelf.
Yeah. And I love it because, again, that's what makes us exceptional. Now, some people might call him a heretic, you know, others might call him genius or a hero. The truth is probably in the middle there somewhere.
Yeah.
But what he's saying is so important, because this country has a long history of subjugating people, subjugating females. I mean, we just celebrated the 19th Amendment, right?
Yeah.
And then someone says just recently in one of the political conventions, I'll let you guess which one it was, that each family should have just one vote and the man should be the one voting. Are you kidding me? But that voice is there.
Yeah.
We need to hear that voice, and we need to be able to respond to that voice. And we need to have relationships with people, be in communities. Mm-hmm. That's why I would advocate for churches. If you're in a church, not, you know, in a like an Episcopal church, where there are going to be people that are all over the map on some of these things,
yeah,
where you can engage in conversation. I saw it happen with my friend's church in Austin. And they, even though there were those who believed that his window, Robert E. Lee's window, should remain, when they heard the story of the other side, they trusted the people who said it, then they were able to make the decision to remove it, because they'd rather have it removed than have some people hurt.
Yeah. And that's the important thing, is knowing it's absolutely bigger than yourself.
Absolutely. And that's what being in a community is all about. And ultimately, that's what we are. Mm-hmm. We're in the American community, even though it's been divisive. I've been around for some time. You know, I can remember the 60s. I was just a kid. Someone once asked me, did I go to Woodstock? I said, well, I was only like 7. I didn't go to Woodstock. You know, but I can remember back then.
Yeah.
And so the current, our current situation, that we're in with this divisiveness is not brand new. That just didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
There's a historical, underlying historical path of that. But again, as I said, the good news is that we tend to deal with it eventually. And this will be dealt with eventually, hopefully in a creative and life-giving way, not in a destructive way. Because, I'm all over the protests for racial justice now. I think that's really important. There's mm-hmm. a long line of history of that as well. I mean, going back to my two heroes in my life, one is Martin Luther King Jr., and the other is Robert F. Kennedy. And both of those guys died in the same year, and I can remember that very mm-hmm. clearly, and how sad and grim it was. And then the Democratic Convention took yeah. place in 1968, and everything looked like it was all going to hell in a handbasket. Guess what emerged? We emerged. Things changed. We didn't get things changed immediately, and they're not going to change immediately now. You know, and I know a lot of people were disappointed. A lot of people that are 20-somethings that I know were really disappointed that Bernie Sanders didn't get the Democratic nomination. And mm-hmm. One thing I said to my own son, I said, let's wait 4 years for the revolution, you know. Let's try to get some things right side up again, and then let's begin to tackle and push for some major systemic changes. I'm not suggesting that racial justice should be delayed. That's not what I'm talking about at all. That needs to happen immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the more systemic issues that are so deeply ingrained in our country may not change overnight. But we keep pushing, we keep advocating, we keep protesting, we keep engaging people in conversation that are different than us. We try like hell to get out of our echo chamber and participate in a larger conversation. And as I said, that's why I think churches are so good. Unless you're going to some sort of reactionary church, it's all about saving an imaginary path.
Yeah.
That these conversations can take place, and there will be people on different sides of the issues. I think that's something to celebrate.
Yeah, that's so true. Daryl, this has been an amazing interview. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Do you have anything for our listeners if they anywhere that you think they should read or anything along those lines?
Oh, goodness, there's just so much.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I'm reading now at my camp site. It's a book by Scott McKnight called The Myth of a Christian Nation.
Mm.
That's just outstanding. I would recommend, I mean, if they want to follow me on social media, I'm always giving suggestions on what to read or what I'm reading or quoting. But I think the number one thing would be just to encourage everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a grief, and you feel it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel it. There's a grief of what's going on here. There's a fear, and as I said, the arc of the universe, you know, the arc of justice bends in the universe, you know, towards justice, and that's something that we can't forget. It's not to just never give up,
mm-hmm.
to keep pushing, to keep talking, to keep learning, and to be open, to your friends that are different than you. And I think that if we could create a generation of people that contain that great American value of being self-critical, but also with an openness and a heart for others, we'll get through this.
Yeah.
And I really believe it is. But to recognize the grief, and then do the grief work. And grief work basically is to move yourself right alongside of it, and feel those feelings.
Yeah.
And then begin to ask the question, what am I being called to do? How can, you know, is it participating in a protest? Is it writing my senators? I mean, talk about something that feels so impotent, writing a congressperson. I mean, that sounds like, oh, well, God, can't you do something else?
Mm-hmm.
But all of those things added together do make a difference. Pay attention to where you spend your money. Are you spending your money? It's a vote.
Yeah.
If you're spending your money in places that support, that support things that you're against, stop it. Do your research. You know, just don't assume. You know, and I have hope. I have hope. I know too many people your age, both nieces and nephews and my children, you know, that give me a great deal of hope. I do not, even though I feel the grief, I do not struggle to sleep at night because in the end, love wins.
That is so amazing. Thank you so much. If our listeners do want to find you on social media, what are your handles?
Just Darrell Proffitt, Darrell, Proffitt. You can Google that. You'll also find I have a website where I do some blogging, and you'll find all that. Google, even though I don't like their algorithms that keep me in an echo chamber, they do reveal all of that. So I could give you my handles, but I don't have them memorized. So you'll just have to Google it, and you'll find it.
Yep.
Or better than that, what is that, DuckDuckGo? Yeah, DuckDuckGo. They don't keep all your information.
Oh, good to know.
I Google that, so. Yeah, you don't want to use Google.
Yeah, it's all out there. Today's show. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at sitstill_lookopinionated and on Twitter at sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malky, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. See you next week. Bye.